This week, we're training up the next generation of shearers and finding out what life's like for a Chinese national working in the Pilbara. A Tasmanian pig farmer proves you don't need a big property to be commercially viable. Would you believe he's got just 10 hectares on Bruny Island? And bison replace cattle in the camp drafting arena. Apparently, they're great to train with.
All right, let's go. Nice. Mouth on the outside. Top side.
It's really slow. I suppose going back to preschool, you're just learning step by step slowly. It all comes together at the end of the day, hopefully.
Well done.
Camp drafting bison, who would have believed it? That story later. But we start today in South Australia, where some keen new trainees are being put through their paces.
It's a familiar sound for many farmers, the buzz of the shears in the wool shed. But one unique thing about this shed is the age of the shearing team. All of them are TAFE college students. Hello, I'm Lauren Waldhuter, and for the past 3 weeks, about 30 students have been stationed at Tatalpa Station, just outside of Yunta in South Australia's pastoral area, working their way through the property's 15,000 ewes. They're learning a range of wool industry skills, not just how to work the shears, but also wool handling and classing too. Chantelle Long is the team leader and is being kept busy keeping them in line.
Handless, keeping them in line so they don't yell at each other and rip each other's hair out, which is what they seem like they're going to do, but it's the second to last day, so they'll pull through.
So explain to me a bit about what's going on in the shed, you know, what everyone's doing.
Lots of them are learning how to do this job, so there's a few that already know what they're doing, and the rest of them are here to learn from the more experienced ones and from the trainers that are here. The shearers shear the sheep, and then the wool handlers will clean up after them, pretty much, bring it to the table and, like, skirt the fleece. And then once that's done, then I class it and put it into different lines. So when the presser bales it up, then they get baled up and sent to market. So all the different wool types are priced differently. So then it gets marketed and sold, and generally it goes to China to get processed and made into clothes.
What kind of things are you looking at when you're wool classing?
If the fleece has colour in it, or if it's like cotted, which is like a really, really hard fleece to pull apart, what the crimp of the wool looks like, that's about it.
It's widely acknowledged the shearing shed isn't for the faint-hearted. Wool handlers run back and forth, sorting, packing, running back again. The sheep bar loudly as they wait in their pens, as dogs leap over their backs. The noise of the shears is loud and constant. David Reichelt is one of the shearing instructors with TAFE.
Oh, when the students turn up, three or four of them have had no experience at all, and a lot of them are all at different levels, but we still start from the basics and go right through. So anything that happens in the wool industry, in the shearing side, the wool side, we teach them right from the ground up so that they've got a really good idea. Because when I learnt, not too many people showed you too much, because you might have got their job, but these days we're really looking for people in the sheds, and the quicker you can show them and they can learn, the more they more stay and they quite enjoy it. They're not struggling, so it makes it a real big difference when you're getting shown the right way all the time.
How many shearers out there these days do you think would have formal qualifications through TAFE?
Nearly three quarters of the shearers in South Australia, I reckon.
And that's more than, say, 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, the schools have become more and more popular. They started out where there's only one or two sheds, and now there's 10 or 12 sheds now, so they've got more and more popular, and there's been more interest in different areas. So if you've just got one in one area all the time, you don't seem to get a broad audience. But if you scatter them all around the state, yeah, you tend to get a lot more young ones from every area.
Because I guess, like you said, it's really diverse and you get to learn a bit more about the industry. So people that perhaps thought, oh, I might want to get into it but don't necessarily want to commit to one area, this is a good thing for them.
Oh, for sure. We've got students, some of them that are waiting to go to college, you know, they've got a year gap. One of the girls that's here, she's got a year gap and she's come out wool handling. So when you get a spare minute or not doing much, they can go and do it anytime they like once they learn. Because you don't forget, it's like riding a push bike. You never forget.
Finally, the noise dies down and the team heads up to the dining room for lunch. Ben Lively is from Lucendale and says he loves the industry.
It's hard work, but it's, I feel good at the end of the day.
So how would you describe your skills?
Ooh, Don't know about that. Well, this is probably, I've done 3 weeks before I came here, and yeah, this is about it, so.
And what was your job today?
Shearing.
How many sheep did you get through?
I done 24 that last run, but they were a bit smaller, but the weathers I didn't do too many, they were a bit tougher, so 14, I think, in the weathers.
Do you think you've gotten better?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely improved. Learnt new tricks and how they got a bit quicker. And
what's the future got in store for you in terms of shearing?
Just want to do a lot of travelling and, yeah, travel overseas and shearing and around Australia and have a look around.
For Ryan Bald, the plan is to take his new skills back home to Kangaroo Island.
I was doing 12 or 13 a run when I came here, and now I'm up to, well, just got 18.
What do you find most interesting about the wool industry? Is it the shearing or is it something else?
Oh, I just like it, the whole lot in general, like farming in general. So I've been in the sheds ever since I was 10.
So it must have been, I guess, the boy within would have been excited to finally get out there and start shearing.
Yeah, I used to help Dad in the sheds when I was young, after school.
Have you got any tips for me if I was going to, you know, get the shears or maybe something a bit easier?
It hurts. You have to put up with the pain. You get a sore back, sore joints. Just, yeah, basically everything hurts. Yeah.
How do you push through that?
A few painkillers.
It's hard to give you a sense of the scale of the place that I'm visiting today. Not just because it's home to some of the biggest trucks I have ever seen, but because the group behind this project is equally large in its global presence in the resources sector. CITIC Pacific is the largest dedicated special steel manufacturer in China, and it's majority owned by the Chinese government.
Yeah, go ahead.
G'day, I'm Lucy Bell, reporting in from the company's Sino-Iron Mining, Processing and Port Operation here at Cape Preston, about an hour's drive south of Karratha in Western Australia's Pilbara region. I've been invited to meet one of Sino's employees to get a sense of day-to-day life in a place like this. In particular, how a Chinese national finds work up here as a fly-in, fly-out worker. Now, mine sites aren't normally open to the public. In fact, it's usually an invitation-only experience. And sure enough, my trip here today, initiated by Sino, involves being accompanied by a media manager for the company and its site manager.
Hi, guys.
Morning.
How are you doing?
And who do we have?
Lucy. Bell.
I have your paperwork here.
Our first stop is probably one of the most important places on any site, the crib room.
There's a Chinese community on site in the camps, and normally they are engineers. We normally getting up together after works and just go around the camps and talking, or maybe sit down, have some beers or a cup of teas and talking to each other, sometimes about work, sometimes about life. So yeah, it's pretty good. And sometimes for now, because we stay here a long time, we have lots of Australian friends join us, so we're talking to each other, get familiar, and we both enjoy that.
Slightly built, with glasses, a soft handshake and a very big smile, Zhao Minghu has been working here for about 3 years. He's a senior process engineer, and after an early start this morning, he's pretty hungry.
Noodles, some veggies, and chicken, and watermelons. Now I'm a bit familiar with the Australian ways. So we had morning teas, afternoon teas, maybe in the morning we break in the middle, so 10 o'clock. So just come in and grab a cup of teas and some biscuits.
What makes this place different to many other Pilbara mines is what's being dug up here, magnetite. A fine, black, almost powdery substance. It's low-grade iron ore, and it requires a lot more processing before it's exported to China's steel mills. Zhao Ming proudly shows me some of the equipment used on site to reduce the magnetite size. And I'm not joking when I say that it wouldn't look out of place on the set of Star Wars.
Now what we look at is the what we call our ball mill. And the ball mill is like 1,100 meters long and 6 meters in diameter, 6-7 meters in diameter.
Just huge. Huge yeah. is the word that we're looking for
there.
For the most part, though, Zhao Ming spends his days in the control room of the mine.
Normally, we just look at the computer screens and checking the trends and just adjust the equipment parameters, like speed or deliver amount or something. Yeah.
correct. It's a long room. We've got our maps on one end of the wall and a big lot of television screens in front of us. And so we've got views of inside the crushers. We can see the conveyor belts, the dump trucks. We can see what's going on in almost every part of the operation. So this is really the nerve centre of the mine site. What did you know about Australia before you moved here?
Kangaroos. Yeah, the story just from the books, from televisions, and even from jokes like the rabbit. Yeah.
What rabbit joke? Tell me that joke.
Okay, there's one boy asking his father, like, why Chinese building the Great Walls? And the father just told him, just to prevent the rabbit.
I like that joke.
People love that joke always. Now my swing is 2-1, so 2 weeks on site and 1 week off back to Perth. My wife and my two kids is in Perth, so sort of settled down. They love Australia, especially like my son. My elder son, is when he come to Australia, he's only 1.5, and now he's 5. And my second son is born in Australia, and now he's 10 months. So they think familiar, they're more familiar with Australia than me.
The situation in the camp, do you have photos of them up in your room? Describe your room for me, what's that like?
My room is fantastic. Yeah, we have a big room, we have our own bed and toilet, bathrooms, and have showers, and have personal desk, and have a cabinet, air conditions, and internet, television system, and especially for this product, we have Chinese television center because they're using satellite, which is very good for us because we can share the information what's happening in China.
Do you have much family still back in China?
Yeah, my parents and my parents-in-law, they're in China, and I haven't been back to China for 2 years, but sometimes the parents come over. So we apply for the visa for them. They can come over to see us, see the grandchildren, and they also saying it very good because compared to China, the environment here is very good. Blue sky, clear, yeah.
Pilbara mine site worker Jiao Minghu, ending that report from Lucy Bell at Cape Preston. Sounds like he and his family are enjoying their time in Australia. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, a camp drafting clinic that uses bison, not cattle, and we meet Bruny Island pig farmer Ross O'Mara.
Come on, mate, we'll come out here, we'll close the gate. So the property which we have is not massive, it's 25 acres, so about 9.8 hectares, which, you know, on Australian standards, to actually use as a functioning farm it's no chance, because most people, this stuff like this is a hobby farm.
It might be small, but this little property certainly packs a punch. G'day, I'm James Eurster, and today I'm with pig farmer and chef Ross O'Meara and his young son Felix on their property here on Bruny Island, just off the southeast coast of Tasmania. Ross and his family take what they call a nose-to-tail approach to farming. They use every part of the animal to make a range of pork products, which are then sold at local farmers' markets, showing you don't need to be big to be commercially viable.
Living and working in Europe for so many years, you see a lot of small places over there that can actually function, and they actually take the product which they're actually growing and then produce it on their farm, and so they get the major product which comes out like a high-end artisan style product. The pigs that we grow on the property, we're just value adding here on the property and then just making the product from that and just taking them and distributing in town at the farmers market. Unfortunately, I have to take the pigs off from here and get them processed off the island to get them commercially killed. I bring them back on whole, and then I process the whole lot, nose to tail, use every single part of it. I do bacon, sausages, pork rillettes, make some pork pies, terrines, other olive old style charcuterie products. And the next part which we're going to be doing is actually taking all the paddocks we've got and turning that in and bringing in lamb. So this part here, this is pretty much all I use to process all the products that we make.
What's some of the equipment we're looking at and that you're using here?
Well, it's pretty much the normal double stand-up fridge. I've got the Cryovac machine, heavy-duty one, just stand-still sinks, just the flat bench here. Got the mincer, a couple of sausage cannons, and in the shed I've got my smokers, a couple of small little home-style smokers, because I pretty much range at processing 1 to 2 pigs a week, which is all I need to do to keep it flowing and keep things happening.
What's the benefit of having pigs on farm rather than using another form of livestock?
Pork's such a versatile animal. You can do so many different things out of a pig, like commercially wise, if you're thinking about all the different products that you make. So many different styles of bacon, ham, all the basic things that a lot of people eat within their normal life. The pigs we try running are old breed, so they're a Berkshire, plus I also have Wessex Saddleback bloodline through there as well. I've got a sow, but predominantly Berkshire. I run a Berkshire boar. And also when you're doing it free range and giving them the space, they take quite a bit longer to grow. Doing that and actually letting that happen, it has a distinct flavour and a taste, the pork. And I think a lot of people are starting to realise that instead of the mainstream bred animals that are just pumped through to actually, you know, keep the numbers up and, you know, keep the prices down, that actual pork and a lot of other animals, if you grow them out lower and slower and take that little bit of time, it's, you know, you get a very different tasting meat.
Well, I reckon we should go continue the tour and check them out.
No worries. Come on, mate. I know they are noisy, aren't they? I know. This motley crew have been in here for a little while since I've been away, so these guys will all be sorted out through a different part. This is the big fella here. He's about 207 kilos.
Has he produced the majority of what we see around us?
Everything. Everything.
How long have you had everything up and running here for now?
When we started up with this main paddock here, as you can see. Being the fact that I came from a cooking background, and so the farming was all new to me, I decided that I'd only run a boar and two sows to start off with. We ran that for probably a couple of years, and then slowly we started building in where the first business I was running with a friend, we were getting a butcher to make a lot of the products for us, plus we were doing some of them here, and I had a commercial kitchen license, but at that stage that kitchen wasn't built. With the actual kitchen being built, that kitchen's just over a year old, which has been an absolute asset. So since that's come along, it's actually changed the whole direction of it. I don't want to get too big, which is the main thing, because once I started getting too big, then I've got to start employing people, then I've got to start doing a lot of the other stuff, and I want to keep it direct and keep it small, as low impact as possible.
Is that a tough thing to try and maintain?
Yeah, it is. It is, because, you know, when you go to the markets and you sell out of your product and everyone goes, oh, why don't you make more? You kind of think, well, why don't you? But the way I've looked at it is I've set out a certain amount, and to process, to grow it, I can still quite easily manage it. And it's, you know, it'll be enough just to make it livable here for us, which is the main core, you know.
So in essence, you've got an idea of where you'd like to cap it at and then keep it there?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. We'll just watch out for this car coming across. Oh, it's Billy. Neighbour.
Are you a Tasmanian local, or how did you find yourself here on Bruny Island?
No, I'm originally from Western Australia. I lived down in the wine district down there for quite a few years and ended up coming down to Tasmania for a holiday and came down on the island and asked Nick up the end of the road for a bit of work in the cheese factory. Because it's the one thing I'd never done is made cheese, and ended up making cheese there for 2 years and pretty much bought this place and got stuck down here. But I don't think we're ever going to leave.
Thanks for showing me around, Ross and Felix. We've really enjoyed the time. Thanks very much.
No worries. Cheers, James. Are you going to say goodbye, James?
Bye, James.
All right, let's go. Nice. Out on the outside. Woo-hoo. Top side. Out you go. Out wide. I see you'll catch him. Just keep going.
A horse and a rider chasing a beast around a stockyard. Nothing unusual about that, is there? Well, what if I told you the beast in question was, in fact, a bison? Yes, you heard correctly, the Native American bison. Well, that makes things a little bit different, doesn't it? Hello, I'm Kim Honan at a camp draft training clinic at Willow Warren on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, where they're using these bison, not cattle, to train up would-be camp drafters.
Stay behind him on the inside. Now come up on the inside a little bit. Keep coming up the inside a little bit.
Apparently bison are well suited to the job. They're slower than cattle and don't tire as easily in the yard, making it easier for riders to learn the correct cutting techniques.
Right, now around the outside.
The dozen animals being used here belong to Kendall Nielsen.
To the bucket.
They don't go sour like cattle. We can keep using them. I'm pretty fortunate with the ones I've got trained that I can slow them down and speed them up for, doesn't matter who we're doing it with. If we've got a beginner to an advanced, or same with our horses, if our horses are green to advanced horses.
Good, stay there. Keep going behind his tail now, chase his tail.
Well, talk me through the procedure when you actually got the bison here in the camp and you're directing and trying to train the rider.
when we start in the camp, we only put one in at a time. So what we're trying to do is get the horse and the jockey into position. The beauty with the bicycle, if I've asked them to come up and they're in the wrong position, we can stop, tell them where they are, and the bison will stand there and wait in the position till we get them, tell them, explain what's gone wrong, and then we'll get them to work backwards and forwards across the camp and getting control on the horse. If the horse isn't keeping control, we can just stop and the bison will stop and wait. We get it all happening again, and we'll cut out in the camp, that's in the yard. And then once we get them cut out in the camp, we go out the gate into the big arena. We've got a course set up, same as what we are drafting, and we can slow the bison down or speed it up to with whatever we're going to do. And we're trying to get the jockey to manoeuvre the cow around the course and get in the right position, get your horse controlled, get right shape, and the biggest thing is we're looking for our safety, so they're learning to where the safe place to be. That's the beauty of the bike. They slow down, run nice, neat round circles in the right position, and so they can learn where the right spot is and the wrong spot is and be really safe. That's our biggest thing for our drafting, to be safe.
Gavin Saul is a relative newcomer to the sport of camp drafting with only 12 months under his belt. He believes training with bison is ideal for both him and his horse.
It's interesting because you can just go nice and steady and, like you said, position your horse. You can stop your horse, get him under control and go again. The bison's still there waiting for you. You know, you're not chasing them all out of the paddock.
And so you're learning a lot more than what you would be with cattle?
Yeah, cattle is really quick, so you've got to think quick too. Where here, you can take your time and think of what you're doing and actually getting in the right positions, and the instructors are telling you to get in that position, and you've got time to do it. It's really slow. Like, I suppose like going back to preschool, you're just learning step by step slowly, and it all comes together at the end of the day, hopefully.
Right down there. There you go. Go, 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 go,
the 20
go.
Riders taking part in this weekend clinic can thank Sharon McKeever for the event. She's the secretary of the local camp draft committee and keen to improve training, not just for novice riders, but also more experienced camp drafters like herself.
Everyone that came has improved or bettered in some way over the weekend. It's beneficial to everyone. If you get to a point to say that you can't learn from someone, it's a pretty sad state of affairs. You can train all day, every day, but you can't see what you're doing wrong. And it's just so good to have someone like these guys turn around and say to you, try this or try that. And yeah, you just see an automatic response. Your horse, that worked. And yeah, even little things like, a classic example is we get told not to tail on turn. Like if you do a tail on turn at a camp draft, which means you turn your tail of your horse to the beast, that's automatic whip in the yard disqualification. But sometimes the older experienced horses, they start to do what we call cheat, and they're pushing up on their cattle too hard, or they're not going to a fence hard enough. So these guys are able to say to you, okay, it's a training situation. You don't have to keep going. You take the pressure off and you do something else, and then you come back to your cow. And that makes all the difference in the world.
And because they don't tire like cattle, is there a lot of demand by camp draft clubs for these kind of clinics?
We're doing a lot of clinics now, so yeah, it is. And just not camp draft, there's a lot of pony clubs now that are, when they have their camps, that they do it. So yeah, it's getting a bigger demand for people for training, because cattle are getting harder to get with so many competitions on, where I can turn up with a small number ahead and we can do a weekend and go home again.
Dungog-based bison breeder and trainer Kendall Nielsen, ending that story from Kim Honan.